Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
What is it like to be an avalanche specialist, a conservationist, a wilderness traveler, a Buddhist? Brad Mickeljohn is a longtime Alaskan who has written a new book titled The Wild Trails that explores these topics and more. On this show, Brad discusses the challenges and rewards of helping others in the natural world, including his work on restoring the Aklutna watershed by moving an old dam, working with the Aklutna people and others. His insights on recreation, conservation, and self-growth are based on his work as an avalanche forecaster and educator. Co-founder of the American Pack Rafting Association, his role is Alaska State Director of the Conservation Fund, and his many significant trips to the Arctic and other wild places. For the first time in 2 years, I'm in the studio, very exciting, and I have Brad Mickeljohn as my guest. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Good to be here, Paul.
So, Brad, you got a book out called The Wild Trail, so we're here to talk about that, but you have an amazing amount to share with people. So why don't we start with just telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into the outdoors.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I'm really, really pleased to be here. I've admired your work for a long time. I've been in Alaska for about 35 years now. I originally grew up on the east coast of the U.S. in New Hampshire and trailed behind a 90-year-old grandmother, Elizabeth Hillis. She was quite a spitfire and a formative person in my life. She was one of the original women's suffrage workers who fought for the right to women, for women to vote, and won that right back in 1920. And she was also one of the first women rock climbers in North America, climbing with the Underhills, Robert and Miriam Underhill. So we trailed around behind her in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, me and my two brothers and three cousins. And it's kind of where I first got my indoctrination into the wild, growing up with muddy, wet sneakers and living in the brook and chasing salamanders and such like. And after growing up in the Northeast, I eventually made my way out west, worked as an avalanche forecaster in Utah for about 10 years. And after surviving that phase of my life, I moved on to get a master's degree in botany at the University of Vermont. And straight out of grad school, I got the job that I have now. I've been the Alaska State Director for the Conservation Fund since 1994. And the Conservation Fund is a national land trust that focuses on protecting America's great outdoors. So I had that pleasure of working here in Alaska, sharing the work and the passion, working pretty well together, and falling in with the great adventure crowd that is here in Alaska with folks like Roman Dial and Luke Mell, and found my way into pack rafting and all those assorted adventures.
Yeah, it seems like you've been that sort of not silent partner, but the guy behind that made a lot of those trips happen. They wouldn't have been able to do it without you.
Well, I think I carried most of the loads on those.
I did too.
Didn't get any of the glory, but that's okay. I'm not in it for the glory.
Yeah. Let's go back to the book a little bit. Tell us about the book, how it's organized, why you wrote it. It's a very interesting, small but just packed with a lot of great wisdom and stories.
I appreciate that, Paul. The book is called The Wild Trails, and I self-published this book in early this year in 2022. And I'm happy to give the book away. I'm not selling the book. And if folks are interested in getting a copy of the book, they can email me. I'm sure that will be in the show notes. Yeah. I like to characterize the book as part memoir, as part conservation polemic, and part Buddhist training manual. And it's a collection of 26 short pieces. Most of them are readable in several minutes. And they cover a whole range of different sort of inner and outer explorations. Some of the pieces I've had written as far back as 1999, and some are much more recent here in 2022. And I think the stuff that really interests me these days is the confluence of sort of Buddhist thought and conservation. And So that's where I've been kind of taking my writing in the last couple of years. And I've been giving the book away and getting a lot of interesting feedback from it. You know, it's very personal. It's about a lot of my challenges in personal introspection and my challenges in dealing with depression and my, frankly, addiction to adventure and my need to be on adventures to be happy. And that's one area that I really hope that we can spend a little time talking about here, because I see it quite common in the Alaska outdoor community that there is some fraction of that community that needs to be doing adventures to be happy. And I was in that situation, and I found my way out of it. And it can be a bit of a trap, and I have lost roughly 34 friends of mine now to various accidents and to suicide. And I see there's an interesting connection there between adventure and sort of an addictive relationship with adventure. So anyway, it was the book was my attempt to kind of, clear my thoughts, understand what I was going through, and see if there was anybody else who is in a similar situation. And I've had a very good reception from the folks who read the book, and that's been really gratifying.
Yeah, it really struck a chord with me. Let's dive right into that a little bit. The outdoors benefited you, and so what were those benefits? Like, what drew you? I mean, besides you had this role model of your grandmother and your family, mm-hmm. but there must have been something that kept you at it and kept accelerating your need for whether you want to call it adrenaline or being out there. Can you talk about that? Because I think people relate to that. Like, why that connection between needing to be in the wild and whatever personal stuff is going on.
Yeah, I think we, as humans have an innate attraction to nature. I mean, it's what we evolved with. We, evolved with in the natural world for tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, and we have a need for it that we can't fully understand. I think it's innate to us. And the way that we kind of satisfy that need now has been a little bit distorted. It's become more of a sort of a transactional relationship rather than a reciprocal relationship. And so what I've been trying to figure out is, is there a better way to relate to nature to fill that need that we have that is more rewarding and more reciprocal to nature? And that's kind of what I've focused my life on, is that blend of being out in nature but also paying back to nature. And I've come to the kind of point of view that if you're not paying back, you're just sort of a free rider. And we're at that point on the planet where there is a tremendous need for us to give back. It's been interesting in the last couple of years during the time of the pandemic how much there's been this surge in outdoor recreation. I think a lot of people have realized what a solace it can be, especially in these trying times when a lot of other things aren't available to us. People really flock to nature, and there's a drive, there's a thirst there for it, but it becomes a little bit warped through sort of this recreation culture where it's really more of a superficial relationship as opposed to a deeper transformative relationship. And so that's kind of my little hobby horse these days, is encouraging a slightly more introspective relationship with nature, more of a reciprocal one where we're giving back as much as we're getting from it.
Wow, there's a lot there. You talk about in the book of us, and you just mentioned it, being part of nature, and that we always were, and that in the last 200 years, we've removed ourselves from that. And that, do you want to expand on that a little bit? Like that idea of what our role, humans' role in this modern world with nature?
Yeah, it's not something that I fully understand, but I think that is true, that we've sort of created a dichotomy where there wasn't a dichotomy before, where we used to be immersed in nature. Nature was our natural medium that we evolved with and lived with all the time. And now it's nature is more out there and we're in here, and we're sort of struggling to reconnect with it in distorted ways. And so I think that manifests itself in a lot of the, kind of social dysfunction, a lot of the psychopathy that we see in culture these days, a lot of the mental health issues is due to this sort of disconnect from nature. And I think we try to put a Band-Aid on it by, you know, through the various recreational pursuits. A friend of mine, Matt Rafferty, refers to it as the recreation rat race. And I think here in Alaska, we have a particularly bad case of that because of the intensity of our short summer seasons when you can be out doing a lot of the things that we like to do in nature. It kind of magnifies the problem where we're just trying to jam, 12 months of living into 3 months of summer. And it creates a bit of a mania. And you can see it really this time of year when, you know, the sun is up for 18 hours and people are out, you know, mowing their lawns at 2 a.m. and just going nonstop trying to pack a lot of living into a very short amount of time. And, you know, some of that is, you know, completely understandable because of the seasonality of Alaska, but it can, in certain people, and it did in my case, lead to a bit of an obsessive relationship with nature where you're just trying to constantly pack everything in and do the coolest trips and keep up with the cool kids and be, you know, one of those guys who's looked up to. You know, Alaska really idolizes people who are always out on the coolest trips. And I certainly fell into that trap. And maybe I was one of those guys that other people were looking up to. I don't know. That wasn't why I was doing it. I wasn't, you know, involved with outdoor recreation for the adulation. That was never part of my MO. But I see it. You know, I can see it in friends who, you know, I've distributed copies of the book to, and they've said, yeah, I can see myself in that. Like, I was caught, or I still am caught, in the recreation rat race, and where my identity and my satisfaction and my happiness are really tied up in what I'm doing and what gear I have and what trips I'm going on and what cool kids I'm hanging out with. And so I, you know, part of the book is to help people understand that there's another way out, that there's a different way of relating to nature that's just as satisfying, perhaps more so, and that it actually may be healthier for some people. I'm not here to say what the right way to be out in nature is. There's a million different ways to do that, and it's always great that people are in nature. We need more of that, and that's been one of the great things about the pandemic, is people have really been out seeking solace in nature, and nature's there to provide. She is that ultimate shoulder to cry on and source of support, and she provides, basically nature provides for us. And you know, one of my themes is that we should provide to her, that it really should be more of a reciprocal relationship than it has been up until now. And, you know, the planet is, maybe it's a little overstated to say it's in crisis, but, you know, we look around the world and there are a lot of indications that things are a bit out of balance and that we're a little bit out of balance. So I think bringing, you know, ourselves back into closer connection with nature, a more intimate relationship, a more reciprocal relationship, is, you know, part of my program these days.
This is Paul Tordak. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm with Brad Mickeljohn, who's published a book called The Wild Trails. Brad, in your book, you start off with the idea of is versus ought. And I think that, why don't you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there's a British philosopher by the name of David Hume who said that you can't derive an ought from an is. And is what exists in the world, and the ought is sort of what we would hope the world to be. And that there's a strain of philosophy that says you can't basically extrapolate from what is to what ought to be, that the ought is a kind of an external imposition. And, you know, frankly, I take a different view, and I'm actually okay with the imposition of the moral imperative about what should be. And so I've never really actually struggled with this question of is and ought, but, you know, philosophers dance on the head of that kind of pin. And for me, you know, I can see nature and I can see that, you know, that it's in its intact way, in intact form, that it does provide for us. And I want to see that continue. I want to see that nature is continues to be there for us and that we're there for nature. And so the ought for me has always been really clear that, you know, if you have salmon in a river, it'd be nice, salmon ought to be allowed to remain in that river. We should consider the needs of salmon when we think about our own needs, when we think about where our power comes from, and when we think about where our food comes from. You know, we're part of a reciprocal chain of existence that we have evolved with for, you know, 3.8 billion years. We're part of nature, and thinking of ourselves as separate from nature has not proven to be a very healthy way of being in the world for us or for nature. So just an interesting little philosophical question. I never had a problem with the is-ought question. I think nature has a lot of value in and of itself beyond what it does for us. And I, you know, devoted my life to seeing that she continues in an intact, healthy way.
When you started your career in avalanche work in Utah, mm-hmm. and you made a pretty abrupt change to conservation work, do you want to talk about why that happened?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, I first got into the whole avalanche realm when I was living in Alta, Utah. I was working at a place called Alta Lodge, which is right at the base of High Rustler, one of the premier runs, powder runs in North America, right on the front side of Alta ski area. And late in the season, the ski area knew that they had a prolonged deep slab instability. And so on closing day at Alta, they lined High Rustler with explosive charges. And at the count of 10, all the charges went off. And this whole mountainside that was moguled from top to bottom came marching down the hill. I still remember marching moguls was sort of the mantra. And the run from top to bottom from, roughly 2,000 foot of elevation drop ran down to the ground, an 8-foot foot crown of snow. All the snow came down in one go, and I was just completely blown away. I'd never seen anything like that. And so the next day I hiked up there to look at the fracture line, kind of marvel at this phenomena that I had no understanding of. And so from there determined that I was going to try to figure that beast out a little bit. So I went back to college and finished my work at Middlebury College, trying to understand avalanches in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And then from there went on, returned back to Utah, worked as a ski patroller, and then worked as an avalanche forecaster for the Utah Avalanche Center for about a decade. And in my last year working at the Utah Avalanche Center, we had a major avalanche accident in the LaSalle Mountains in southern Utah. We had trained two guys to start a satellite avalanche program down there out of Moab. And they had been out, those two guys had been out skiing with four of their other friends and coworkers, and they had triggered a massive avalanche in a place called Talking Mountain Cirque in the LaSalle Mountains that had buried all six of them. Two of the people happened to survive, get themselves out, and dig out the bodies of the other four. And I was called that night to go in and help with the body recovery. In the meantime, storms moved back in. It snowed for the next 2.5 days, and additional avalanches came down and reburied the body. So by the time we got back in, several days later, there were mountains of avalanche debris, roughly 30 feet deep. And we had to locate the bodies by probe line because the two guys that had found the bodies had turned the beacons off and skied out just to save their own skins. And so we got back in there. We had to do additional avalanche control to bring avalanches down, and then finally got teams in there with probes and recovered those four bodies. But it took us, I think, 3.5 days of trenching and probing and trenching and probing to turn the bodies up. And there was one guy in particular, a guy named Jeremy Hopkins, who I'd helped train in a level 3 avalanche workshop just about a week and a half before. And I found him on a probe strike and ended up digging him up. And it's just seared into my memory, his sort of mannequin-like appearance with his eyes open. And I really felt like I had failed Jeremy in not telling him something about avalanches or giving him the wrong impression that avalanches could be figured out. And so that was a real kick in the seat that drove me out of the avalanche business, because I no longer felt like I had anything to share with anybody else about avalanches. And that's kind of common in something like avalanche forecasting, where the longer you're in it, the less you feel like you know. And what's interesting is you look at a field like physics, and most of the esteemed physicists at the top of the field have said similar things, that the longer they're in the business, the less they know. And I've, you know, that was difficult to come to grips with, that notion of uncertainty, but it's something that I am now embracing, and maybe it fits more in line with my Buddhist practice of that embracing uncertainty is healthy, and that what I've seen in the course of my life with friends who've been lost in the mountains or in the rivers or by their own hand to suicide is that the quest for certainty is a trap, and that the experts who think they have it figured out are those who are next in line for a comeuppance, for a slap upside the head or maybe worse. And we shouldn't be surprised when the people that get into trouble in the mountains or in the rivers are the experts, because they're the ones who think they have it figured out. And so that's a real perilous trap. And having being humble, having modesty, not having hubris, not feeling like you're top of the world is a safer way to go through life. And it's a much more satisfying way to go through life. And just embracing a healthy level of uncertainty is it's going to keep you alive a lot longer than feeling like you've got it all under control.
I think it's really interesting, this confluence that comes out in your book about art and science and uncertainty and this idea of being present. Really fascinating to me that we think that we can use technology or whatever to get ourselves through this stuff. But yeah, nature doesn't really work that way many times.
Yeah, there's a book that I just recommend to everybody. It's a pretty intense tome called The Master and His Emissary. And it's written by a guy named Ian McGilchrist, who's looking at the different brain hemisphere functions. We have two brain hemispheres. Basically, all higher life forms have two brain hemispheres. And the question you have to ask is why? And the two brain hemispheres provide different functions, and they work very well together. But the left hemisphere is tasked with sort of grasping. It's tasked with getting, sort of a reductive view on the world, where the right hemisphere is sort of the more global gestalt context oriented way of looking at the world. And McGilchrist argues that in the modern world, the left hemisphere, instead of serving the right hemisphere, has become the dominant hemisphere. It's sort of the left hemisphere run amok, because we're inundated constantly with a huge volume of information that we're trying to sift and sort and make sense of on a really rapid basis. And it's driving this left hemisphere dominance to the detriment of so many more subtle forms of ways of being in the world that rely on context, that rely on subtlety, that rely on metaphor, that rely on humor, that rely on, you know, art and religion and whatnot. And that there's a way to get back to a more balanced way, but it involves, you know, deep immersion in nature, perhaps psychedelics, perhaps religion and metaphor. And I find a lot of meaning in that. I see kind of the modern world running off the rails. You know, you don't have to look too far to see signs of sort of sociological psychopathy in lots of different manifestations. And so this is a really interesting take on what's happening in the world and how we might really kind of globally fix that.
Yeah. I started a few years, instead of taking pictures all the time, but drawing. Because a lot of people are doing it, in my mind, I mean, I've always done it. But I think in my journals, I try to remember to sketch things. And just taking that art part, I thought has been very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just to tie in something else here, Paul, that there's something that is really powerful about ritual in our lives, like weddings and funerals and services and parties and whatnot. They provide a lot of meaning to us. And I think one way to deepen our connection to nature is to have more in the way of rituals in our in the way we interact with nature. My friend Tony Pirelli has just a really simple thing where the first spot of water that he comes across, whether it's a creek or a pond or just a little puddle, he'll splash water in his face just as a way to, like, that's his ritual of being in that place and connecting to it and kind of triggering a different part of his experience. And so I think, you know, art and poetry and metaphor and religion, all these ways, they tap into a different way of being, and they're really, they provide more balance.
Yeah, that's great. So you were into the conservation work and moving, I suppose, from the is to the ought a little bit.
Yeah.
But you continued with these pursuits when you moved up here. What role did the sort of long endurance type trips play in your conservation life?
Yeah, it's absolutely essential to me, at least in connecting me to my work. It's why I do the work. It's where I get my passion for the conservation work. I go out on as many long trips as I can, and a lot of people give me a hard time on it because they say I should be working more, but it's where I derive my intimate knowledge of the land from, and I feel like I can really talk from a place of deep familiarity when I'm working in conservation because I know these places intimately. Like, I have been to the Brooks Range for every year for the past 40 years, and I know almost every single valley in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and some of them I've been to multiple times. And it's one of the my pet peeves in the conservation community these days that there are very few people who take the time to really immerse themselves in nature, and it provides a lot of benefits. It provides a lot of depth of knowledge to your work, and it provides, at least for me, it provides the passion, the inspiration to do what I do. And the more that I know about it, the harder I'm willing to work for it. And so it really is the wellspring for all of my work. And you know, I've had the luck of traveling widely around the world, and I've really come to see how special Alaska is. And I'm devoted, you know, not to, you know, preserving it in amber, but to see that it's still here to evolve in its own way for as long as I can make that happen. It's a real rare treasure. And if you haven't been outside of Alaska, if you grew up here, you really need to see what the rest of the world is like, because it's the wild is shrinking fast. I worked for a time as the president of the Patagonia Land Trust in Chile and Argentina. And, you know, that's a dramatic country. I love that part of the world. But compared to Alaska, it's nowhere near as wild as Alaska is in terms of having the natural abundance of the native species here, the native fish here, the native predators like bears and wolverine and wolves, and the wide-ranging herbivores like the caribou that we have. I mean, what we have here in Alaska is about the last of the true wild, and we really need to take good care of it. It is Alaska's special sauce. I mean, you can find oil, you can find minerals in a lot of parts of the world, but you cannot find wildness very many places. And so to my way of thinking, the wildness is what makes Alaska special. And it doesn't stay wild by itself. It takes a concerted effort to keep it wild. And it's typically what we see in these places is sort of a death by a thousand cuts, as small actions add up over a long period of time. In Alaska, you know, we've got kind of a jump start in terms of geography and time, but Alaska, there's nothing inherent that is going to keep Alaska wild. It's going to take a concerted, determined decision to keep Alaska wild. And, you know, fortunately, we have this huge network of protected areas of parks and refuges and national forests and state game refuges. And most of those exist in a context that's wild, but those sort of matrix lands, surrounding lands of private lands and state lands, over time will get developed, and over time our parks and refuges will become islands like Yellowstone and places like that, where they're isolated and wildlife can't move between those areas freely. They start running into roads, they start running into developments, and sort of this natural wild matrix is lost. And I like to think of Alaska as really the best example in the world for how to do conservation right. We've got something like 46% of our land base in conservation areas, and right now there are various proposals going around conservation circles for what's called 30 by 30, which is protecting 30% of each ecosystem type by the year 2030. And that's a goal of the Biden administration, and that's been adopted fairly broadly worldwide. Others talk about, you know, half for nature, or this half earth proposal that E.O. Wilson put forward. And I think, you know, half for nature may be a better goalpost to aim for, a better measure of what really is going to be needed. And so I like to think that Alaska's greatest export is our sort of role model as a conservation example.
That's great. We're going to take a quick break. This is Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twardock, and on Alaska Public Media. We'll be right back with Brad Nicholson.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
All right, welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm here with Brad Nicholson. Brad, let's before the break, we were talking about conservation. Let's talk about some of the many, many things you've done to make the world a better place, really, like to because you have done a tremendous amount, whether it's an acre here, like you talk about in the book, or big projects. Let's start with the Klutna Dam project. That's been a really wonderful thing to watch.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. That's easily been the most rewarding part of my conservation career, is taking down the old Klutna Dam in Klutna River Canyon. And that project happened over the last 5 years. It's still ongoing. We're still trying to secure water back into the river. But in a nutshell, a dam was built on the Klutna River back in 1929. It provided power to Anchorage for about 30 years, and was decommissioned in the 1950s when an additional power project at Klutna Lake came online. And that dam was abandoned, sat unowned and unmaintained for the next 70 years. And I was inspired by a movie called Damnation that Patagonia came out with about the national dam removal movement, and was inspired to go find a dam to take down. And that was the closest one I could find. And it was ready and ripe. And we were able to put all the pieces together to take it down. It was a great collaboration between ourselves and the native village of Klutna and Klutna Native Corporation. And it's been super rewarding because of how much support we've had. Basically, everybody and their dog has been enthusiastic about this. And we're optimistic that over the long term, we're going to have a natural river restored. And I see it as an object lesson and what Alaska has done right with regards to salmon. Part of the reason we still have so many salmon is because we haven't built dams on our rivers. Salmon and dams don't play well together. And here's a case where we made a mistake. We learned from that mistake. We took the dam down, and the fish are coming back. And that's the really exciting part, is how fast these rivers recover once you take the dams out. And, of course, in the lower 48, there are something like 90,000 dams, and salmon are in really tough shape in the lower 48. So the first step, if we're serious about getting salmon back into our rivers in the lower 48, is to take down more dams. I've come to see these rivers as arteries, and we can do a lot of land conservation, but if we're not taking care of the arteries that provide the nutrients that drive these systems, then we're not doing conservation the way it should be done. And so I'm actually working on a dam removal project in Maine. I'm looking at a couple others elsewhere, and I'm really inspired by that work. It's some of the most gratifying conservation work out there. At the same time, I'm still working on some large landscape conservation deals. We currently have a project out in the Iliamna region. It's roughly 44,000 acres of conservation easement surrounding the Pedro Bay village at the east end of Iliamna. And that would additionally block the proposed corridor for the proposed Pebble Mine, and that would protect some of the last remaining great salmon habitat in the world. So we're currently fundraising for that. So if anybody's got a few cool $1 million they'd like to help us fundraise, that's a $20 million project, and we still have a pretty significant gap that we're trying to raise money for that by the end of this year. So thanks for asking.
In your book, you have a chapter called We Eat the View. And I think this ties in with this dam removal and salmon. You want to explain what you mean by eat the view?
Yeah, there was an expression, I think it was some old sourdough, who said, well, you can't eat the view, that, you know, all this scenery doesn't really do you much good. And I actually take the opposite view here in Alaska, is that, you know, the scenery provides the context that puts food on our table, that the view contains the wild rivers, the view contains all the habitat for caribou and for moose. And we're eating that view all the time. And I think the notion of living off the land, it really doesn't exist anywhere besides Alaska anymore. Subsistence has really become an artifact of the past in most parts of the world, but we still have that capacity to live off the land because our view is intact, because the landscape is intact. What you're seeing in the view is still there. And so, you know, we have politicians who say, oh, you just want to turn Alaska into a big snow globe. Well, actually, you know, we eat the snow globe. You know, that's what put food on our table. And so, you know, I can't quite grok the mindset that wants to turn Alaska into New Jersey with mountains. Like, if that's what you really want, there's plenty of that out there. Everywhere else but Alaska is like that. So if you love a wild place, this is one of the few left.
And when you think about that, the idea of food and food security, I guess I'm thinking about people who might say, well, maybe those dams are needed for, let's say, energy as an efficient non-carbon source. What would you say to that?
Absolutely. And there are plenty of hydropower sources here in Alaska where you can develop that without impacting salmon. There are ways to do that without making that trade-off. And, you know, Bradley Lake, for instance, there's a new dam down by Sitka that was recently raised by, I think, 74 feet to power hydropower down there. So there are plenty of places around Alaska where you could develop hydropower without impacting salmon. And I tend to think of salmon as our ultimate renewable resource, and it shouldn't be a trade-off. We can have both. So it's a matter of doing it right and doing it the Alaska way.
Another thought that occurs to me is when we have this amazing state with all these amazing natural resources of salmon and caribou and moose and plants and how, and in your book you talk about, like, sometimes you don't know something that you've never experienced,
right?
And so even you and I know a state from 40 years ago that's different than it is now, in my case, Prince William Sound, and, you know, pre-oil spill versus post-oil spill. You know, how do we articulate that to a younger generation? How do you, because, for instance, you had this, saw this movie, and like, oh, that's the ought. That's how the Lacuna ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get that across?
It's a real barrier. It's this notion of ecological amnesia. If you haven't experienced it or if you've forgotten it, you know, you don't know what you're missing and you don't want to, you don't have the drive to get it back. And so I was inspired by a book called Wildlife in America by Peter Matheson that wrote about the natural abundance that used to be, you know, across most of this country in terms of the birds, in terms of the fish, in terms of the bison. And I was like, wow, that has disappeared, you know, a lot of that in my lifetime. And I am going to, you know, fight tooth and claw to keep that from happening in the last place that it still exists. And so you know, if you're a student of nature, you can find out what used to exist, but it does take some digging and you have to be inspired to find that history out. A lot of us don't really realize what used to be here. And that's partly true in Alaska. We have this concept when it comes to fisheries management of over-escapement, but there's some really interesting research that's been done on nitrogen 15 sequestration in lake sediments, where we're seeing that you know, salmon bring nitrogen 15 in from the ocean. And these ancient sediments from back before we had commercial fishing show nitrogen 15 levels off the charts compared to where we are now. So I suspect we're managing for salmon way below the natural capacity. So it currently affects us. We don't really know. It's that continual shifting baseline where you don't know what the actual target is because you didn't fully factor in what the history was. So it's a perennial problem, and it you kind of get swept along by history. You can't keep things preserved in amber. Change is the eternal constant. But you have to think about what the capacity for the place is and what the history might have been and what its potential could be. And that's what I'm always driving for, is like maximize the natural potential of the place. Don't just manage for the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, and what we see and we go, wow, that's great, there's a moose or there's caribou, but trying to imagine what it would be even more so.
Yeah, and I think this is a good place to segue into the challenge of working in conservation, where you're fighting this eternal battle, and it always feels like a negative fight because you always feel like you're saying no, no, no. And I tend to flip it around and say, no, I'm saying yes. I'm saying yes to life. I'm saying yes to fish. I'm saying yes to birds. I'm saying yes to clean rivers. I'm saying yes to clean air. And there's a great quote from Ram Dass who said, you know, you can't expect to live in a world if you're not peaceful. And I know a lot of people who work in conservation are not peaceful because they're angry, they're burnt out, they're frustrated. And yeah, there's another great quote that the world is perfect, but it could be better, right? So having that mindset like, okay, it's not the way I want it to be. It could be better. I'm going to do my darndest. I'm going to, you know, set my shoulder to the stone and do my part. But I have to let go of the results. Like, all I can do is have the intention to, you know, to make a difference, but I can't control the outcome. And a lot of conservationists lose sight of that. They want to control the outcome, and they're frustrated when they don't get their way. But, you know, it's a planet of 8 billion people, and everybody wants to have their way. So none of us is going to get everything we want. But it's just like, you know, you do the best you can, and it's a relay race, right? Like, that's the nature of conservation, is that you do your part, and then you pass the baton, and somebody else does their part. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. And I just think having that willingness to participate, it can be really demoralizing when you look out and see the magnitude of the problems. But it's always been that way. There's always been problems. And it just takes steady, you know, perseverance. And it's like, I'm going to do my part, and whoever's going to come after me is going to do their part, and on and on and on. It's just like that. It's never a finished job. It's not like you're just game over and job done.
You have a great quote in there. I look at a Greek or Roman writer that talks about all the problems of humanity back in the day.
Oh, right. Yeah, from Tyrolean. Yeah, I think that's from 350 AD, where he's talking about, you know, all the forests are cut down and all the rivers are running sewers and the planet's overcrowded. And, you know, that's ever thus. That was from 350 AD when people had that perception that it was all too late. Well, it's never too late. Like, the planet's going to survive without us and something's going to go forward. I just happen to be really attached to nature, and I feel like I want to give all the things that we evolve with the chance to have their own destiny, like live out their lives and have a chance to evolve in their own ways.
Great. This is Alaska Public Media, Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Twerk. I'm with Brad Mickleton. Brad, talk about this idea that we'll continue on this idea of the economy versus environment. And you mentioned that being a false choice.
Yeah, it is a false choice. You know, I see the economy being a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. And, you know, there's no jobs on a dead planet, right? Like, so we live in an amazing place at an amazing time. And I want to keep it that way. And I, if you want the world to resemble some other place, I'd say, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for you to move. Alaska really should be the benchmark for how to do conservation right.
Let's move. The work for the Clinton has been great, and there's a video people can see, watch about it out there. It's a really great project. Let's go to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's been a passion of yours. Been up there for 40 years, as you mentioned earlier.
Right.
What is the latest up there regarding drilling and development and versus preservation?
Well, I'm hoping that the storm clouds had largely passed on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. There was a lease sale in the waning months of the Trump administration. It was largely a bust. The industry had been pushing, and politicians had been pushing for that for many, many decades. The lease sale was held. There was almost no interest in it. There were some leases sold. And I think over time, we're going to see those leases reacquired, hopefully by the Biden administration. But I think that was the real tell, that the industry really didn't show up for that lease sale. So I've always wondered whether that was a bit of a red herring to keep the conservation community distracted while development happened elsewhere up on the North Slope. I'm optimistic that we're going to start moving away from fossil fuels. We need to start doing it rapidly. If you haven't read the book, The Ministry for the Future, it's a very eye-opening book about kind of the near future of what's going to happen on our planet if we don't take climate change seriously. It's already happening. So I think Alaska could stand to be at the forefront of addressing climate change by getting ourselves off of fossil fuels.
Yeah, very important. Let's go shift again a little bit. So you've been at the conservation world. You've been in the dealing with lots of tragedies in the outdoors. Let's talk about your shift to Buddhism and how that's helped you and how that might help other people deal with whether it's burnout and these constant battles. And, you know, we can talk about conservation work, but it goes for a lot of things. We're recording this in May. We've just had another mass shooting. So this the pandemic still going on. So this sort of constant barrage of things that cause anxiety and stress. But we can focus on the conservation part because that's we're talking about the outdoors. But how does what insights do you have for folks?
Yeah, I drifted into Buddhism sort of as a last result. I was struggling with depression for a long, long time, and went through a lot of different modes of treatment for that. And I think I had developed a bit of a addiction to adventure, and needed to get a handle on that. And eventually, after a lot of other failed treatment modalities, I went to a meditation retreat, a 9-day meditation retreat. And if you want to understand your mind, it's a great way to be forced to look at what's going on in your mind. And it's interesting that, you know, we spend, as outdoor people, we spend a lot of time with our gear and working on training our bodies. But very, very few people that I know spend an equal amount of time training their minds. And I commend it to people. I am leery of waxing too evangelical about it because it's a very private matter. And the more that I evangelize about it, I think the more I turn people off. So if you're interested in it, there's a lot there. I commend people to look into it. I think it's a way of looking at the world that was developed 2,600 years ago, and it's really stood the test of time. The Buddha was quite an astute guy who understand the workings of the mind in a way that is really insightful, and has helped me tremendously see sort of the traps that the mind sets for itself, and has helped me sort of put some things in context. The ideas of impermanence and not self and the cause of suffering, seeing the mechanics of suffering. We create a lot of our own suffering, and seeing how we do that and how we can stop doing that is really, it's a treat to have that refuge, to be able to step away from that. So if anybody's interested, I'm happy to talk at length about that, but I think most people aren't really interested, so I tend not to talk about it. But I do have a quote.
Let's read this
quote from the book, and it pertains more to the kind of recreation rat race, I guess. So the quote from the book is, getting to the place where your life has sufficient meaning regardless of what you're doing at any one time, that's the key to happiness. The meaning you derive from life should not depend on what you do. It depends on how you are inside yourself, how you are inhabiting your body. And it's entirely possible to have the same experience, that peak experience, the euphoria, and not go anywhere. I'm 100% certain that's possible, and we're not talking about drugs. I'm just talking about mental training, about meditation. So again, if you want to understand the way the mind works, sit down and look at it. It's really as simple as I can put it.
I think in the book you talk about the cycle of, in the context of adventure, recreation, adrenaline-type sports, the trigger, the behavior, and the reward cycle, and trying to break that. Can you talk about that a little bit, like in the sense of how, not necessarily with Buddhism, but how that might be applied to that cycle?
Yeah, the mechanics of physiology of how we satisfy our cravings, how these cravings develop, what they feel like in the body, and what they feel like after we attempt to satisfy them. That's what I'm talking about, like taking the really close, granular look at the mechanics of how we suffer. And so there's a whole chapter in my book called Nothing Missing, in which there's this sort of notion in modern world today of fear of missing out, FOMO, that other people are always doing the things that you wish you were doing. And I guess I would argue that you don't have to buy into that trap that trying to satisfy your cravings is an endless and unsatisfying way to go through life. I tried that. You know, I tried to live the constant perfect adventure. I think we have this idea that if we string together all the right elements of our life, have all the pieces lined up, have the great cup of coffee in the morning and the right partner and the right house and the right job and the right location and doing cool trips with the right people with the right gear, that that's the definition of a happy life. And I'm here to tell you it's not. that it's actually much simpler than that. And if you try to go about it that way, you're never going to be happy. If that's what you think happiness entails, it ain't going to work out for you. And that it's much, much simpler, that you can find that happiness. It can be available to you no matter what you're doing, if you're stuck in traffic, if you're at work, if you're doing something that you really don't like doing, you can still be happy. And I know that sounds paradoxical, but that's sort of at the root of Buddhism, is just finding that happiness within yourself.
And yeah, that's great. And also, I think we haven't talked about birding yet. you're a big birder in the sense that it's a passion of yours, and as it is mine. And one of the lines you have is see the bird. And I think that was a great maybe example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, birding is prone to a lot of these addictive tendencies too, because the top birders are always wanting to see something they haven't seen before, so they're in a rush to tick things off on lists, as opposed to really appreciating, I don't know, the simplest bird, like a robin, or I go to the post office in Eagle River and there are eagles in the tree outside the post office. And yeah, I grew up in a place where there were never any eagles, and I'm never going to take eagles for granted, because if you do, that's the way you develop ecological amnesia. When you start taking things for granted, and they start dropping off and you don't notice. So it's like, you know, appreciating the most common things, like, you know, just robins or abundant eagles. I was a what's called a lister in birding parlance, where you know, fly around the country and try to see birds that are wayward lost souls, and they might be the last of their kind. And the rarer they are, the more valuable they are to a birder. And something struck me as a little bit strange about that. It felt like a kind of form of collecting feathered spoons. And so, that chapter, Birding with the Buddha, was my attempt to make sense of my passion for birding. And what I've decided is birding is just kind of a portal for me to enter the world. And if I'm looking for birds, I'm always tuning into my world. And so I've sort of dropped the competitive aspect of birding, which doesn't really make any sense. How can you be a competitive birder? That's just bizarre. And really just try to be more appreciative of everything that's around me, especially birds.
Yeah, especially I like the part about seeing the shine of the magpie or the raven or something like that.
Yeah, if you catch a magpie in good light, what a stunning bird. But, you know, we see them all the time. We think they're pests. People hate them because they make a lot of noise. But, God, magpies are just stunning birds.
Yeah. What you talk about big ideas for wildlands. Talk about that a little bit, what you mean by that, and maybe what some of your big ideas are. Besides by taking down dams, for one, but what else?
I think reintegrating people back into nature is probably the biggest idea out there. You know, how do we successfully do that? How do we break down that dichotomy that seems to have been set up with nature out there and humans in here? I think getting back to a more intimate relationship with nature is really the future of conservation, and kind of integrating people more closely in the landscape. And there's some critique about wilderness as a undue separation between people and nature, and I see it as sort of a stopgap, that we need to have these wild places protected for that day when we've found a way to be more harmonic, live in a closer integral relationship with nature, that maybe there's a point where we can sort of immerse ourselves back in, as opposed to set it aside from us. And I think the challenge right now is just to make sure that there's enough there that, you know, we get through the kind of the eye of the needle. There's a lot of challenges out there right now. It's a very crowded planet. Population is something that people don't really want to talk about. And yet the planet is, we've got 8 billion people on the planet right now. And the connection, to my mind, between climate change and population is just undeniable. The growth curves, when you look at the curve of carbon dioxide accumulation in the atmosphere and the human population over the last 100 years, those are basically parallel curves. And I acknowledge that correlation is not causation, but more people equals a hotter planet. And we're facing a really interesting future, and I don't think it's dire. The planet will somehow survive. We may not, and a lot of the beautiful things on the planet might not. And I think that's a shame, but I can't control that future.
Mm-hmm. And what advice? We've been talking about a lot of things here, and again, this is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Paul Twardock, your host on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking about Brad Mikeljaina's book, The Wild Trails. Mm. We'll have Brad's contact information. You could get a hold of him for a copy. And it's a great read. And so what advice would you have for, to a 26-year-old? Mm. Think about yourself back when you're 26 and whether it's conservation or adventure, or what kind of advice would you give to whether it's an adventurer, a conservationist, or even a birder?
I guess I would say if you don't run your life, somebody else will. Like, do what you want to. There's a great little short movie about a guy named Slow-Mo who's way in. Have you ever seen that little thing about he's a rollerblader? And Slow-Mo talked to some guy. He used to be like a brain surgeon, Slow-Mo did. And he decides he's going to just spend his life being a roller skater because he meets this guy in recovery ward. And the old guy says, do what you want to. And that kind of sums it up for me. I've done what I wanted to, and I haven't really followed the conventional wisdom. And I've just done what needed to be done. And I haven't always done it the way that people would have recommended that I do it, but I did it, I guess, like Frank Sinatra said, I did it my way. And, that made all the difference. And so follow your passion. Just find a passion early in life and do what you can with it. Because, as time goes on, your options start to narrow down. And develop a dream and go for the dream, like this, dam removal project I had. People have talked about taking the dam down for, 20 years, but nobody could wrap their heads around doing it. And I just said, well, we're just going to start and we're going to see where this leads. And, sometimes taking the first step is really like the catalyst. The magic happens when you take that first step. You don't know what's going to unfold, but you're taking a step in the right direction. You're developing intent and you're on a good path. Like, you have good intentions and they're going to work out. You don't know where, you don't know how. But I think in just setting your intention in a positive direction and sticking with that intention and seeing where it takes you.
That's great advice. Thanks for joining us, Brad.
This is really fun, Paul. Enjoyed it. Thanks.
This has been Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I'm your host. We've been talking with Brad Mikeljaina in his book, The Wild Trails, which is, you're going to have to get a little Brad to get a copy of it. And we'll have that information on the Outdoor Explorer website.
Thanks to my guest, Brad Mikeljaina. Brad's book, The Wild Trails, is available directly from Brad, and his contact will be on the Outdoor Explorer website. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to our producer, Airport. This is your host, Paul Twardock, and from all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.